Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, April 20th, 2015. Opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. And I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 5502 related to the Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Siebert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the Department of Administrative Services here to continue their discussion of rates and assessments, and they have some case studies to go over today.
Excellent. Mr. Naughton, Ms. Holly Valenzuela, anybody else coming up right now? Yes, maybe.
Ms. Savaro.
Ms. Savaro's coming. Hello, Ms. Savaro. The floor is yours, and my apologies to the group if I shout on my lunch because
it's all good.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton, the Acting Director of the Department of Administrative Services. We have a number of case studies we're going to talk with you about today. The agenda is to walk through these case studies, finish up the conversation about the rate structure for the Department of Administrative Services for 15-17, and then we're going to move into some work that's been happening on long-range planning for our facility side, which is really a package that you all approved last biennium. We want to showcase some of that work for you so that you can see what your investment last biennium did, and we have a package in this next biennium to continue some of that. So before we get into the case studies, you have this presentation, should be up for you. I'm going to start on slide 4, which is just a recap of the thematics that we talked about yesterday, and then we're going to move to slide 22 after that in the case studies. But really remember that there were three big things that were happening that were driving up overall rates for everybody. It was the Human Resource Information System. That's an IT project to replace the state's personnel system. Inside the Chief Information Office, it was that expanded role of oversight for IT projects in the state, which was strategic technology officers and analysts related to this thing we call stage gates. And then finally, it was a fairly large increases on replacing some outdated equipment and trying to set aside money so that we will not be so far behind the curve in the future. As we get into these smaller agencies in particular, though, what you're going to see is that the cost allocation model between agencies has driven up some rates in some of these small ones, and we'll talk about that explicitly. The two that we talked about here were the fact that the assessment model for enterprise technology services was driven off of a FTE and budget size with a minimum charge, which a number of these small agencies did not have the minimum charge before. But then also inside of the enterprise human resources, where there are services that are purchased from Department of Administrative Services, accounting and personnel in particular, there had been an implicit subsidy or an explicit subsidy for a lot of these small agencies over the years, and that actually was changed in this 15-17 biennium in the budget proposal brought forward. All of these are policy choices that you can make a different decision on, so that's partly the reason we're spending time on it. With some of Senator Whitsitt's questions last week, we found one after our conversation on Wednesday that I was not as familiar with. That same rate subsidy issue that we're seeing in enterprise human resources on the personnel side, there was also a subsidy on the accounting side. So Senator Whitsitt was referring to costs rolling up in the next biennium, 2017-19, and as we dug into it, we found that actually is correct. If in the 15-17 biennium, they were only picking up 25% of the cost increase in 15-17, and if you continue that practice into the next biennium, 2017-19, you would actually have another roll-up as well. But we'll talk about that when we get into these examples. So we're going to now jump to slide 22, which is where we actually left off. We'll advance through to that. 21.
This one?
Oh, yep, that's correct. 17. Slide 17. And we're going to start the conversation about the Board of Tax Practitioners. Now, this is the overall growth for, again, these same slides that we had before. 2013-15 is on the left. The blue part is what we call the assessment side of DAS. And the orange part is the the orange part is the fee-for-service side. And you'll notice that on these, both the assessment side and the fee-for-service side are all going up by a fair amount from 2013-15 to 2015-17. If we go to slide 18, we'll break apart the blue part first. Advance one slide. This is the subcomponents of that blue piece that you just saw a second ago on where the increases on the State Government Service Charge Act are occurring. So to orient you to the slide, this is the same picture you've seen before, and we'll start with the Chief Operating Officer on the left, which is three bars. The blue one is 2013-15, legislatively approved budget. The orange is the 2015-17 agency request budget, as we talked about last time. And the 2015-17 gray bar is the what was recommended in the governor's budget for 2015-17. Chief Operating Office, notice it's the same pattern you saw in the previous, when we met last Wednesday. There was an increase in the Chief Operating Officer in the overall budget related to continuing three limited duration positions that are in the budget for project management services. Notice the Chief Financial Office moving forward to the next one. This is a policy choice when we talk about subsidies. The Chief Financial Office has a minimum charge for small agencies. So even though the overall budget for the Chief Financial Office has also gone up, just like the Chief Operating Office, the rate is kept low for both this board and Accountancy Board, Board of Accountancy, because we are making the explicit decision that we want to keep those rates low. Now, the policy offices, because it's not really a fee-for-service driven model, that really is a policy choice that we will revisit with some of these other conversations. Chief Information Office, same pattern that you saw before when we talked about the overall budget, as is the Chief Human Resource Office. But notice the ones on the far left, Enterprise Technology Services and Enterprise Goods and Services, ETS and EGS. So notice that for ETS, this is where the assessment is built in for that overall basic charge for all agencies for the infrastructure that's out there. What they recommended as part of the proposal for 15-17 is to split, again as a reminder, the ETS rates to not just be fee-for-service, but the infrastructure part that everyone has to do, move to a methodology for an assessment. And what they recommended doing was using the exact same methodology that the Chief Financial Office uses. So it's a split between the budget size and the FTE of an agency with a minimum charge for small agencies. So this one jumped from virtually zero in 13-15 to the $5,000, same $5,000 charge we have in the Chief Financial Office. Over on the far right in Enterprise Goods and Services, as we start digging into this, we realize that there's probably a methodology change that we want to have conversation with Mr. Siebert about, because when there are four positions in the budget that were moved from the Chief Financial Office over to Enterprise Goods and Services related to procurement services and procurement policy. We made a decision about 3 or 4 years ago to split those functions aside, split those functions apart, the policy and the service side. After doing this for 3 to 4 years now, we've recommended that those be merged back together, and there's a policy package to do that. Small piece with four positions. When we looked at the methodology over this last week or so, we found that that same $5,000 minimum charge that was in the Chief Financial Office was basically added on to the Enterprise Goods and Services. There probably should not be a change for the small agency, the size of this one, for that $5,000. So that's something we should revisit with all of you, that methodology on charging $5,000 simply by these four positions moving across to another division inside of DAS doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's a policy choice.
So let me clarify.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what? Oh, no, maybe you want to add something. So you're saying that when you revisit that gray bar, for example, in EGS, Enterprise Goods and Services, may drop significantly?
Madam Chair, that would be the conversation that we would have with Mr. Siebert. Significant is relative here.
Okay.
Because the scale on this chart is 0 to 8,000. That's mm-hmm. the high part. So it'd come down by $5,000 or so.
Right, but that takes it down below where it was in 13-15 by... It takes it back down to where it is with the orange bar in the agency requested budget.
Madam Chair, that's what we would work with Mr. Siebert about. That's correct.
So they'd have the increase for ETS up to $5,000, but they wouldn't have the double increase.
Madam Chair, that's what we would discuss with Mr. Siebert. You're understanding it correctly.
Okay, that's what I just want to make sure I understood what you were telling me correctly.
Yes.
Senator Whitson, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah, it's terrible, actually, but yes, please.
Do you want to ask him now, or do you want to?
Well, first, a comment. I mean, I know, Mr. Naughton, you just inherited this job, but I don't know how many times now we have merged and separated and merged and separated. And I don't know what the purpose of that is other than to make it too opaque for the committee to actually see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not always merged and separated the same way. So there's very little to compare.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I definitely understand the comment you're making. This is one where we tried something. We found it didn't give us the benefits we were expecting to get, and so we're trying to fix it. So in this case, we are talking about rolling back this part of the overall change, mm-hmm. But you'll see that this is 4 people out of 800 plus inside of the agency. So this is a small one, and we are trying to make sure that we don't have the problem of a double count in this one.
Then the other question, would you refresh our memory on my memory on you're making these assessment per FTE?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, depending on which organization, and Donna can add to if I need to, every different division has different rate methodologies on how they do it. Inside the Chief Human Resource Office, which is a personnel based, it's allocated, I believe, on FTE count. So the bigger the agency, the more they pay, which makes sense. Inside the Chief Financial Office, we do it a combination of both. It's a blend of size of budget and FTE count. Again, trying to approximate where we spend most of our time, which is on the bigger agencies, bigger budgets. But there's a different methodology for each one of these, which is why we've been spending time discussing some of these.
You'd have to be a forensic accountant to follow that.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, this is a very complicated budget. I will completely agree with that one.
I don't want to beat it to death, but I've been on this committee long enough to see this happen before, and it's how are we supposed to compare what you're doing this year with what you're doing 2 years ago with what you were doing 4 years ago and 6 years ago when you keep changing the methodology and there's no way for us to track it?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, anytime you do a major reorganization, which the Department of Administrative Services did 3 years ago, you're always going to lose this ability to look back over time. When we did with the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, we ran into exactly the same problem. I understand your frustration with this. This one's fairly small in the big scheme of things, but 3 years ago, after that point, we can't get back to history. And Mr. Siebert can attest to that. On the go forward, if we can keep some of these things aligned, we will be able to get them so that we can track history. But anytime, Sarah, you do a reorganization, you lose that history.
And my point is, lo, the many times we've heard that same story.
Understood that. So,
sorry, Representative Comp.
Thank you. I really do appreciate Senator Whitsitt's comments. And do other states have this same dilemma? I mean, literally, it's like the Department of Education can't give you. Well, they've gotten better, mm-hmm. but you'd ask a question, and they say, "Well, we can't get that for you." And the dropout rate, excuse me, as a previous high school administrator, I could have told you 12 years ago what the dropout rate is. Now they actually came out with the figure that, I knew 12 years ago what the dropout rate is. And they've only done that in the past year. And, we cannot continue to function like this in any of the agencies, period. Because we don't know what outcomes are really happening.
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, if I can, I understand the frustration with that. Financial information, generally speaking, has been fairly stable. We haven't done a new financial system since the mid-1990s. Some of those systems, though, are very old, and it's hard to pull information out of it that actually makes a lot of sense. It takes a long time to do that, which is partly why we had a proposal to change the personnel system, because we have the same frustrations you're describing. Now, going back to Senator Whitsitt's question, that doesn't change the fact that every time you do a reorganization, and I, as a chief financial officer, run into the same problem, mm-hmm. you lose the ability to track over time with history. And that, unfortunately, is the situation we're in with the Department of Administrative Services. The overall data system issue, though, is a very significant one and limits our ability to get good analysis to all of you.
Yeah.
It is a situation we're very much aware of. Okay. So I'm going to move to slide 18, and you're going to see a similar chart on the service side. Move one slide forward. This one. But I want you to notice first here that the scale on the left of this chart changes pretty dramatically. And you'll notice that we talked about earlier on the policy side and the service side, The service side of the house is roughly 10 times larger than the policy side. So I want you to be aware of scale in what you're looking at. You saw it on one of the very first charts. This is the fee for service side of DAS. And there's three primary places where costs increase. Three primary lines of business. The first one is enterprise technology services, which is a user-based fee on how much computing power an organization uses. Notice for this agency, Board of Tax Practitioners, that number has actually dropped between 2013 and 2015, which is smaller. But it's made up by the fact that you have increases on the other two sides. The middle one is enterprise human services. You see that the gray bar is not quite double what the blue bar is, but it's significantly higher. This is the policy choice we talked about earlier of no longer doing a subsidy on these small agencies. So again, this is the recommendation that there was a subsidy that the large agencies were paying, in essence, for the personnel services of small agencies through the subsidization. And the recommendation from the Customer Utility Board, which is a blend of small agencies, large agencies, and middle agencies, was to eliminate that subsidy, and they recommended the entire subsidy going away in 2015-17. That's the reason for this increase, and again, is a policy choice that you all can revisit. The next one over is enterprise goods and services, and this one is an increase for one of them is the same policy issue we talked about with the shift of some of the services. This is partly driven by the fact that enterprise goods and services rates were lower because we had a beginning balance in 13-15 that we have to, in essence, it was one-time monies that we're able to keep rates down in the 13-15 biennium. So as they have to replenish those rates, it's going to drive everyone's rate up somewhat. So this is the first picture, which is tax practitioners. The big policy choice here is really the enterprise human services with the methodology change and then also enterprise goods and services. So as we talk through tax practitioners and we finish this one up, policy choices on the rate assessment for the technology side, moving to that minimum charge, and this conversation about the subsidy piece. So the next one we're going to move to is Board of Accountancy, which is a little more dramatic, unless there's questions with that. Okay, Board of Accountancy, again, the blue is the state government service charge piece, and the orange is the fee-for-service side. And there's a dramatic increase, especially on the fee-for-service side, and we spent a fair amount of time working through this to understand what it is. So on the next slide, which is slide 21, this is, again, the blue part, state government service charges. The pattern for COO, CFO, CIO, and roughly the Chief Human Resource Officer is the same pattern that we saw with tax practitioners. Enterprise technology services, notice again, we have that $5,000 minimum charge for the technology services. But as we move into the enterprise asset management, there was another rate methodology change that I wasn't aware of in depth, but as we started digging into it, there is something that's called the surplus property program in the state. And the surplus property program, under this next biennium, what was recommended by the Customer Utility Board was to move to a model that the agencies that use this service would end up paying an assessment for the use of it. Board of Accountancy is a fairly actively managed board, and they use this service, and it's based on the 11-13 usage of the program. And they were a user on this one, and so therefore they were one of the agencies that got assessed for the surplus program. So again,
Mr. Nutton, I'm sorry, I should know what enterprise asset management really does. I've probably just forgotten, and I don't understand why the Board of Accountancy would have been an active user and tax practitioners wouldn't.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, enterprise asset management is one of the three big service lines inside of DAS, and it basically maintains all the physical assets. So it is the physical buildings, maintenance of the physical buildings inside of state government. They also run what we call the surplus property program. So large agencies, say a Department of Human Services, as it's updating its equipment, will surplus older equipment, and they will take it out to a warehouse, I believe, which is out by Costco, and then other agencies will go out there and they will pick up
things, desks, chairs, other things that other agencies have discarded and are getting ready to surplus. And then the smaller agencies, I'm not even sure if they pay much of a price for it. I don't think they do pay a price for it. They get that equipment from the larger agencies.
Okay, so let me see if I've got this straight, and I'm trying to try not to sound too snarky, because I don't mean to be snarky.
Mm-hmm.
So the Board of Accountancy decides that it wants to be prudent with its fiscal resources, and it needs a bunch of new chairs. And so it goes out to the warehouse, and it says, oh, look, somebody just turned in a whole bunch of chairs, and they're exactly what we need, and maybe they're not in perfect condition, but we don't really care. So instead of buying new ones and costing the state money that way, we're going to just take these old ones. So then they become active users of Enterprise Asset Management Services, and they get charged an assessment because they're doing this stuff.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding of how the assessment works. How this rate of assessment was actually determined, I actually don't know the answer to that.
I got a serious problem with that one, I got to tell you, Mr. Naughton, and I'm suspecting I'm not the only one at this table who does. Please,
as long
Senator
as we're
Johnson.
We're sharing cool DAS anecdotal stories, I'll share another one with you. The Lewis and Clark Explorer train, this was before Mr. Naughton's time at the helm. We had, in effect, had money fronted for a train to run simultaneously with the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and part of the requirement was that we would sell the train at the end and repay the state for their investment. Went to DAS to resell the train, and they wanted a 25% commission to resell the train. It's that sort of stuff that, I mean, we eventually badgered them out of doing that because you don't sell a train every day. But the point of the story is this kind of stuff, if it isn't brought to your attention, you don't know that it's happening. And I think it redounds to the detriment of state government in toto. And you get a mulligan on this one because you weren't even there then.
Yeah, and on the EAS stuff, EAM stuff too, Enterprise Asset Management stuff too. But we need a little follow-up on that one, Mr. Naughton, and trying to figure out their other agencies. I mean, I can see that charging DHS, if they're going to surplus off a bunch of their stuff and you're going to have to store it or figure out how to sell it, okay, fine. But to charge an agency that's just using it to save money by not buying new stuff when there's perfectly serviceable stuff that other people don't want, problematic.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Haoli Valenzuela. I'm with Business Services. So this is one of the rates that the Customer Utility Board that went through a severe deep dive. One of them was even eliminating the surplus program. So we went through seven different scenarios of how we can have the surplus program run not in the red, because it has been. So generally in the years that have come, agencies would surplus their property to surplus, and a lot of the times the equipment or the furniture or whatever that was given to them was not usable, so we ended up throwing them in, disposing them. So the other scenario is shifting all of this back to the agencies and having them do it themselves. However, that wasn't a viable option because that would just be a cost shift, and then we would be creating surplus properties all over the state of Oregon. So in this case, actually, I'm going to go another direction here. This is actually property that Board of Accountancy gave to surplus to surplus. This wasn't stuff that they had purchased.
It wasn't stuff that they were purchasing.
So we can certainly give you the seven different scenarios that we had went through with this, and then the agencies that were assessed this fee. But basically, it was the assessment came about because surplus needed to be able to at least recoup some of the costs that they were doing to dispose for the state.
That's a different story altogether. So if that's the case, then I'm slightly less befuddled by it. But Senator Johnson.
I got more befuddled. And that is, I think the taxpayers expect frugality out of government. And if the choice, I didn't say they get. if the alternative to have your part of state government save money is for accountancy to say, let's just call the dump and throw this away, I'm not sure that there's value added for the people that have to buy the replacement chairs. And so when you say that the committee did a deep dive, I don't know what that means. And I sometimes wonder when I hear about these committees that are helping guide DAS's policies, whether or not it's folks talking in an echo chamber. I don't know how valuable the advice is. I don't want to incentivize just tossing stuff. I know that some of the big corporations in Portland have a surplus program where they let not-for-profits come in and pick through their stuff. And I don't know why we have to have such tremendous expense. I just don't get why it's so expensive.
Give them the number to Goodwill. They'll come and get it.
So, Madam Chair, we can do a little bit more research on this one to find out specifically with accountancy what was going on. It's a fairly significant program that's out there, so there was a lot of research done on it. We can follow up with it.
It sounds, Mr. Naughton and Ms. Haole Valenzuela, that this committee has a bunch more questions about the surplus program in general,
yes,
and not just about what's going on in accountancy and its use of this service. So if we could have a better understanding of how that program runs, what its expenses are, what happens to stuff. Are you trying to show me something? So that would be helpful, unless it's somewhere else in this, your materials that we have forgotten, Mr. Siebert.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I might just, as part of that information, you said it was operating in the red, which means it was being subsidized by other rates. If you could bring some information about how it was being paid for previously, because I believe that that was part of the impetus for the change, is the agencies that had been paying for the service that never used the service through a subsidy wanted some kind of fee-for-service program or something set up. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman.
The other request I would have for the agency is, when we did the big remodel here in the building, and I don't know about what furniture the Senate side received, but here on the House side, we all received two big filing cabinets. We had this and we had that. And a lot of us only used about two-thirds of the furniture, and then the rest of us went to surplus. And it was brand new furniture, so it would be interesting to see what was the cycle on something like that, if the money came back to the legislative budget or, you know. I just know that on the House side, we had more furniture than what we could really fit in our offices. So,
in the name of frugality, we kept those orange and green couches.
Chair Johnson, Senator Johnson, it's really nice to know, but I mean, recently here in the House side, the chief clerk just bought some new chairs out in our general area in front of the our elevators, and it's like, well, what happened to the other ones? You know, so there's all kinds of stuff, but. Yeah, we did have an excess, not an excess, but
all right.
So, Madam Chair,
I think
we'll
you got
on.
The
okay.
Yeah, you
thank
got
you.
The gist.
Last one, the procurement side, actually related to procurement, enterprise goods and services. Same issue we saw with tax practitioners. There's that $5,000 lump in there that we probably need to revisit. So we'll follow up on that one. So let's move to slide 22, and what you're going to see again, scale difference. Prior slide was 0 to 9,000. This scale is 0 to 120,000. So there's three big issues here that are going on. The first one, enterprise technology services. This is the roll-in of the new model related to the fact that we are able to replace that aging equipment. This kind of pattern inside of many agencies are seeing where the charges for service on the data center have gone up dramatically because we're making that decision to replace equipment and basically double down so that we'll have enough money in the future that we can replace it on an ongoing basis. So that's the big change that's happening there. And again, that's a policy choice. Enterprise human resource services, that's elimination of the subsidy that we talked about earlier. And then moving over to the far right, enterprise goods and services, the fee for service side. We actually spent a fair amount of time talking about this one to try and break this thing apart. And this gets to part of what Senator Whitsitt was discussing. Inside of enterprise goods and services for this agency, there is roughly a $10,000 increase related to accounting services. So it costs them about $40,000 per biennium to get accounting services for this agency for a two-year period for this organization. And as we move into the 15-17 biennium, that increase was going to be about $10,000 on top of that. So that's the first of two things you'll notice right there in the notes on the far left, that there was, that is 25% of that cost in the next biennium. Working inside the state system, he's, I have a brother-in-law who's a VP of finance, a Fortune 500 company. When he and I sit down over Thanksgiving dinner, he is astounded at how long it takes us to do our budgeting process, how we track every dollar, how our systems are set up. It's a very different model in the private sector. Part of those costs, we've actually been subsidizing for these small agencies. The policy choice to eliminate that subsidy is partly why you're seeing these increase on this far left. It's not the only issue, but it's one of two that I'll talk about in a second.
Thank you, Mr. Naughton. There's a, the first is the irony of charging the Board of Accountancy $50,000 for accounting. The second is, now for a fee for service, are you consistent across all agencies per FTE, or does that depend also?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, for this one, it's actually an estimate of how much time it takes for the accounting staff. And they do track that, they measure it. And for this agency, it's roughly a, just on their, we measure their accounts payable, their accounts receivable, and how we charge it out and how much time it actually takes someone to actually work with this agency. Now, this organization is fairly actively managed, which probably means we spend probably a little bit more time with this agency than some others.
If you don't have a follow-up, Senator, I do. So, okay, that makes sense to do it on a time build, assuming that we're being, you know, it's true fee for service kind of thing. $105,000 is salary plus, I mean, a generous salary plus OPE for one FTE person, essentially, right? I mean, it, I don't know how much accountants are paid in the state government, but not a full biennium. You're right, it's half.
Yeah.
It's half. Sorry, half, give or take. Could we at some point see, so one of the reasons that they have to be more actively managed is because they got a bunch of licensees, right? So they've got money coming in and money going out and money coming in and going out, and they've got investigations and, you know, all that kind of stuff that all take accounting time at some level. Would it be possible to get similar information for another licensing board that has a similar number of licensees, or divided out on a per licensee cost or something like that? Because I think that's actually more interesting to see what's going on with the medical board, which has, I don't know, I can't remember. I should remember because they told us how many people the accountancy board of accountancy licenses. Medical board of Oregon medical board licenses about 15,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Nursing boards even a little bit higher. You know, I'd be interested to see it broken out that way, because really that's when you're talking about a licensing board, that's part of the issue, is keeping track of accounts receivable and accounts payable.
Madam Chair, absolutely we can do that. It's also a function of how much they've moved to online payments versus how much is paper checks coming through.
Oh.
There's a whole host of reasons why one agency may be more expensive than another, but we can pull some of that together.
So the medical board, for example, that does almost everything online, they do all their, pretty much all their licensing applications online, all their payments online. That's
Madam
a different
Chair,
issue
it's
than
gonna be much cheaper.
Much cheaper than this one. Who goes to, so in theory, if they really went completely online, that would be a place we would see a savings down the road.
And Madam Chair, that's one of the things this group tries to do, is work with those different agencies and say, if you do this, we think you can save you more money. But we can do some comparisons with other agencies of similar size to see what it looks like.
That'd be helpful. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. When we look at this kind of increase on the small agencies, and I understand there's some correction there, but I have to wonder if we could see figures, say, for, you know, the similar set of figures for, say, Department of Revenue. It would be interesting to see how much accounting you do for them. But, I mean, the fee-for-service particularly, a DCBS, ODOT, I mean, you know, what I'm thinking of, Madam Chair, is agencies that have 1,000 employees or 4,500 employees. What is the increase? Is it commensurate with this? Is it a small fraction of this? Because so, I could see if it's if it's on a, anywhere near an FTE basis, the total cost of DAS is going astronomic in a two-year period.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, this organization basically doesn't serve. Those larger organizations have their own accounting staff that do all this. And because of economies of scale, they can drive their cost per unit down quite a bit. When you talk about smaller agencies, it's not very efficient. That's one of the functions of the fact when you have eight and two-person size agencies, you have to have other people doing it, which is why they contract with DAS to do it. So it is the unit that does this work is DAS's shop, and then they have dedicated staff working to these smaller organizations.
So how big does an agency generally have to be before it makes sense for them to bring something like accounting in-house?
So, Madam Chair, it depends on the agency, and again, with like we talked about before, that's really their choice. We can get you the agency size with the ones we're already serving. Once agencies cross over the 50 FTE side, somewhere between 50 and 100, it probably makes more sense for them to do it themselves.
Okay.
But we have pilots right now where Department of Consumer and Business Services is partnering with Department of Revenue and some others to see if they can get accounts receivable or payroll to co-locate. So it really depends on the agency as to where they think that actually makes sense. Your biggest right now, Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, they have a shared services model between the two of them, and
yeah.
They're two of our largest agencies.
Yeah.
So.
It circles back to a question that I've been asking for 3 years about why accountancy and tax practitioners and other small licensing boards like that are separate agencies as opposed to doing what some of the health licensing boards did and merge into one board to share a lot of those back office functions and achieve those economies of scale, because it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me why we're not doing the same thing for a lot of the other. You know, why are the landscape contractors separate from CCB, separate from, it could go on for a long time.
Yep. So, Madam Chair, I will point out, though, that that's a huge policy question as to why we have small agencies. These ones have contracted with DAS because they're not doing it themselves. They're contracting with someone else to do it for them.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that
issue.
If you got three or four of them together, then they might have enough people that it would make sense to do one or one person in-house instead of half FTE for them and a half FTE for tax practitioners and a half FTE. You might be able to get, for four agencies, you might be able to get away with one and a half people instead of two, whatever it is. I'm just saying that I think we need to keep looking at that question.
That
it's not your
sense.
Issue, but.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure I'm just still struggling here because look at it.
Join the crowd.
He's my voice for my thoughts.
If you look at it from a different point of view, then the Board of Accountancy would have to have an entire FTE just to do these little services, which wouldn't they have eight people and they would have to hire another person to do all these things. I know what in the private sector, if my accounting went like that, I know what I do. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It just the cost of it is doesn't comport.
Madam Chair, Senator Witz, I think this is closer to a half FTE that we spend on this board, for example. Mm-hmm. But the point is still well taken. I will remind you, though, that it is working in the private sector and working in the public sector, because, again, I have these conversations over Thanksgiving dinner. It's different. There are things that that my brother-in-law writes off that we track to the dollar. I mean, it is a different world. And there's a level of oversight that in the private sector you never have to worry about. So I understand the point, and it's well made.
And getting back to my previous question, I wasn't just talking about accounting. I mean, I'd like to see the DOR, DCBS, NoDOT, what your charges are for those three agencies.
Policy, Madam Chair, Senator, which
policy one? And fee for service, and I'd like to see and see the comparison,
Senator?
Between, say, 13, 15, 15, 17, and proposed 17, 19.
Madam Chair, Senator Witz, I think we can do those. Which agencies again, Senator?
I just picked three: DOR, Department of Revenue, DCBS, and ODOT.
Okay.
Ms.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as a follow-up, the Shared Financial Services Unit actually does accounting, budgeting for their smaller clients and boards and commissions. One of the things to note about the Board of Accountancy is, as we were talking about electronic payments coming in, the Board of Accountancy has four different types of payments coming in. Three of them are manual. one of them is electronic. And that is what the Shared Financial Services Manager is trying to do, is to get them to go into an totally electronic, so that we can perhaps maybe decrease their usage into the system. But it's not just the accounting side of the house. They actually prepare the budgets for them, too.
Understood. It does point out, I mean, your point, Mr. Naughton, about the differences between the private sector and the public sector and how accounting is done in those two settings points out an interesting paradox, I think is the best term. The public expects us to be very thoughtful about spending and tracking their taxpayer dollars, as well they should be, and yet doing so at the level that we do it, in order to be completely clear about where those dollars are going, adds to our bottom line. It increases our costs. So it's really hard to know where that sweet spot is between being truly accountable and transparent about how we're spending taxpayer dollars and increasing costs to the point where we're gaining transparency at the sacrifice of spending more money than we need to. And I don't know how to think about that, but it's really being brought out very clearly by your comments and the things that we're hearing here today. I find it an interesting paradox and a problem to think about together.
So, Madam Chair, the last thing I'll say before I leave the Board of Accountancy is that we've been working very closely with the executive director of this agency. He's a good director. He's doing a lot of really good things, and we'll continue to work with him on finding ways to reduce costs. Actually, as we've been having conversation about this, Mr. Padione and I have been having lots of dialogue back and forth, as has he been having conversation with the manager of certain of these areas. So we're working very well together, working through these issues. So the last one we're going to talk about, and then we'll move on to long-range facility planning. This is the Construction Contractors Board. This is a little bit larger agency. They're north of 60 employees or so. Notice that on this one, state government service charges have gone up. Fee for service has stayed roughly the same, not too much difference. We're going to flip to the next slide, though, and you'll see we've merged this one into one place. And notice where the increases have actually occurred. Now, this is by entire divisions. This one is larger, so you don't get the minimum charges anymore. So this is actual cost for a number of different things. Chief Operating Officer, Chief Financial Officer, CIO, and CHRO, those are the same overall budget conversations you see on when we had a conversation on Wednesday. Enterprise Technology Services, notice that we had the large increase in technology services. Again, this is the spreading out of that IT-related replacement of equipment. And then Enterprise Asset Management, which again, surplus and facilities maintenance, roughly flat. And the other one that has grown is Enterprise Goods and Services. And this is, as we've talked about before, some of the beginning balance issues. And I do believe that this organization also gets services from DAS as far as its accounting services as well. So you're seeing some of that roll up of that 25% increase on the no longer doing a subsidy for that organization. So the pattern here on the policy choices here really are around the technology services side and what that increase looks like, and eliminating the subsidy on the accounting side as well. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's the end of the assessment conversation. We have a number of things to follow up on with all of you on questions that we've asked today. And these are all, again, as we've talked from the very beginning of this one, these were policy recommendations that were made and included in the governor's budget, but they really originated with the customer utility boards. Those are policy choices that you will make decisions about when you and Mr. Siebert sit down and talk about DAS's budget and how to fund it. All of these are implicit questions about what is it you're going to fund, which are the packages, and what's the overall cost increases, and then the allocation question of who ends up paying for it. Most of these allocation questions are a zero-sum game. Once you make the overall decision what you're going to fund DAS at, the allocation question really becomes questions of winners and losers. In certain areas, we subsidize small agencies, but it's always the balance of that versus wanting them to make decisions. For example, on moving to online payments, it's cheaper. You want to incentivize them to make that decision. So that's the balance that we're trying to do in the whole thing. And with that, I'll pause before we move on to the next and see if there are any final questions.
Thank you. I have a letter that's was sent to, I think, 22 different agencies, and it talks about some of the increases being as high as 391%. And then it goes on to say, CUB agreed that the best solution would be to limit any 2015-17 increase to no more than 25% of the 2013-15 charges. So if you increased it 25% a year, it would take 14 biennium, take 28 years to get up to your 391%. So two questions. Is that your plan? And second, who pays the tariff in the meantime?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, the conversation we're talking about is if you decide to do a different rate methodology, slow it down, so roll back some of that decision. Probably what happens means the larger agencies continue to subsidize. Ultimately, that's your all decision when you work with Mr. Siebert as to how we spread those costs among various agencies. But if it's not the small agencies picking it up, it usually is the larger agencies are going to have a higher rate to cover that. For most of those larger agencies, it's not as significant in the overall size of their budget. But that's where the policy choice rests, Senator.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Kump.
Thank you. First of all, I really do appreciate you going into the detail that you are, and plus that our colleagues are asking good questions. This is my first time on this committee. One helpful thing that would help us newbies, if you had a glossary so that I would know what EAM means and ETS and chief, a glossary would be helpful at the end.
Madam Chair, Representative Kump, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Thank you both for being thoughtful about your answers. And we recognize that, as Senator Johnson pointed out, you're in a position where a governor wrote the budget who's not the governor anymore, and an interim director is the director of an agency. You didn't prepare that agency's budget. Well, you sort of did. You're the chief financial officer. Mm-hmm. But the point being, there were policy decisions made that you weren't necessarily at the helm for. So you are, we understand, in an awkward position, but you do understand this well, and we are trying to wrestle with it. Senator Johnson.
But it also begs the question, and I used to joke about this because I've chaired this committee in the past, there is a pattern at DAS of blame the dead guy. Mm-hmm. There had been so many changes in directors that there was no accountability. It was when Greenfield left, his successor blamed him. When the next guy left, I can't even remember them. There have been so many. But following on Senator Whitsett's point, the continuity matters for the legislature to be able to exercise any responsible oversight to the degree that we manage the budget. And I there's always a tendency to not want to hold the new guy responsible for the sins of the past, but I just make that observation. I don't know, you've been there a long time at DAS. In the last 10 years, how many directors have there been? At least six, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, you're correct, at least six in that time. And I should clarify, Mr. Jordan, when he was in this role, these were recommendations that were driven primarily by the Customer Utility Board. There was a real discussion about trying to let the customers have more say in what we were trying to do. The splitting of the agency into the service side has been an overwhelming success in my mind, because it has allowed the service side to really focus on listening to the voice of that customer, which is the customer agencies. So that process, I absolutely want to keep moving forward with the utility boards. These individual policy discussions on how to split costs, that is something that we need to spend some time talking about, because you as a committee may have a different methodology you want to discuss.
But just to circle back one more time, I want to be really sure that we've got this clear on the record one more time. These customer utility boards are composed of agencies of every size, and the recommendations that they end up putting forward are circulated to all the agency directors. And although not everybody may have ended up agreeing 100%, is it your sense that they all understood the rationale and they knew what to expect and they felt as if they'd had sufficient input and that kind of thing? I mean, nobody likes to see their rate go up 351% or whatever that magic number is that Senator Whitsett was quoting. But it's a different thing to have that happen in a vacuum versus if you feel that you've had, it's a question of taxation without representation or taxation with representation, right?
Yeah. Madam Chair, yes, my understanding, and I talked with the Executive Director of Accountancy, for example, and this is probably the most transparent budget development that DAS has done as long as I can remember. It was very transparent. They didn't always like the recommendations that came out of it, but they were aware of it. Now, one of the other things is, especially with smaller boards, They have a lot of things on their plate, and it's harder for them to commit to be at meetings all the time. But this was very transparent, was communicated to the agencies. That's my understanding, Donna. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, okay. Because, I mean, this committee has a right to and should ask these questions. That being said, ultimately, I'm not sure it's right if there is a public open process, inclusive process, public in the sense of all agency directed inclusive process. I'm not sure it's the right thing. And if the agency has their saying, this is the most transparent it's been, we don't 100% like it, but we understand the rationale, I'm not sure it's our place to ultimately decide whether that's right or wrong.
That's fair.
I also, the point is also very well taken that larger agencies, and in fact general fund, that's a little bit about general fund that goes directly to DAS, have been subsidizing some of these smaller agencies. That has its share of problems too. Mm-hmm. So overall, I think we all get a little bit of sticker shock when we see the increases, but I think the rationale, from my perspective at least, is pretty clear. I mean, you can make an argument about whether the actual costs are, you know, like whether we're running all these services in the most efficient way, but I have to hope that's happening. I'm hoping that everybody's continuing to look at that question. So I guess that's where I'm coming down on this. I think what's really important for us to understand it, but overall I'd say, okay, we don't have to like it, but it's not our agencies per se, and the cost is the cost, and we're paying for it one way or another, and the only question is how, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair, I agree with that.
Okay, anything else before we move on?
Okay.
All right. Next.
So, Donna, I'm going to let Donna slide out now. I'm going to ask Alice to come to the table with me. This is, as I will set the stage while Alice is coming up. 2 years ago, we had a conversation with all of you about wanting to be much more strategic in our use of our physical assets, our buildings in particular. I've been in state government for 20 years. We have not done a very good job of coming to you with a plan and having conversation about what our deferred maintenance costs are, because we didn't get the job done in the first place to maintain our buildings. And so you gave us some money last biennium, for this current biennium, to actually be much more thoughtful about that. And we were very fortunate. We brought on Alice Vavelle, who formerly worked at the Oregon University System. She's an architect by training, and she has been bringing some rigor to the way that we do our facility planning. We've done some assessments out of actually hired private sector engineers and construction folks to look at our buildings. We started with DAS-owned buildings, which is most of our footprint of actual office space. We did the Oregon Youth Authority, and we also did the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to get their physical assets basically assessed. And the research that you're going to see in the presentation you're about to see is kind of the culmination of that first phase of this, to start to give us a better idea of what our physical assets are. I will tell you that this is a pitch as well, because we have a budget package in for the next biennium to continue rolling these same kind of things out for the Department of Corrections and probably Department of Forestry, because they also have a large number of assets as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Johnson, mm-hmm. Senator Johnson.
Just so I can follow along, I want to cut to the chase, because I've sat in the same committee and been told by your predecessors that they didn't know what their assets were, and that there were buildings that we were actually paying rent on that were unoccupied. Do you believe, as a starting point, as a platform for the work that your office is doing, that we now know what the total inventory of assets is?
And I would say the answer to that is yes.
I'm sorry, could you just introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you so much.
My name is Alice Vavelle. I am the state architect with the office of the CFO at the DAS.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Senator Johnson, Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, to answer your question, I think we have accurate information. I don't think we have precise information, but I think we have quite accurate information.
I guess that just begs the fundamental question: how can you possibly manage without the precise information? We're writing checks to somebody. We've got assets that are either booked or not. we're getting rent from somebody or we're not?
I would say that that level of information we do know.
Okay, then that causes me to ask, what don't we know?
We may not know the exact woodshed that is out in eastern Oregon. I mean, there's that level that we don't know. We also may not have exactly the correct square footage for the assets.
Okay, all right. Yeah, one more. Please. Would we generally know what encumbrance exists on property? For example, if there was an easement through the lot adjoining? I mean, do we know that level of detail, or would that be in the unknown?
I think we can get to that level of detail through our land records. I believe we have that level of detail.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can also jump in.
Please.
When we started this, there, going back to the system side of it, there are multiple systems that have records of, for example, physical assets. We have a risk database, which we use to actually insure our property. We have a asset management inside of our facilities division, which we now call Enterprise Asset Management. As we started digging into this, we found that the same location would have different square footage, different sizes. When we started digging into it, Alice brought me one where we had a on the book somewhere. I'm not going to tell you which database because we've got it now cleaned up. But we had on the books that we had a 1 million square foot building. And we started looking at going, where in the world could that possibly be? We found out it was a typo and there was an extra zero added in on one of our buildings. So that's the kind of work that Alice has been digging through as we start to look at the databases to try and figure out what can we match up, and we're not there yet. So I have a little bit more, Alice is more affirmative than I am. Our job right now is to try and get what is, and you'll see we have a lot of good information. Now, Alice, if you'll start rolling on this one.
Yeah. May I just add one more thing? Colleagues, I think it probably bears further discussion in another committee if ODOT knows what all they have. They have little tiny pieces of property adjacent to highways that they may or may not own, and they have the most Byzantine divestiture process for these lots that are about the size of a bath mat to get rid of. And so,
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, as we roll into this, you'll see the volume that they actually have.
Okay.
Actually, know something about this because my daughter. Sorry, keep going.
Great.
Sorry.
So today I just wanted to talk to you about what our role is, and our role is really to provide decision support for the 10-year strategic plan. We organize our work around six principles. One, we design for quality, steward our investments, right-size our portfolio, contribute to the whole, which means we consider our impact on communities and the state as a whole, convey our identity, the identity of the state, and build for resilience. And that means we protect and adapt to risks. So those are the overarching principles by which we are engaging in understanding our portfolio. Our approach is to gain a baseline understanding of what exists and why. And this goes to your the questions that you raised, Senator Johnson. Our approach is also to develop tools and share best practices to increase performance, lower costs, manage risk, and create value. We're looking for high-performance, low-cost solutions, and what we endeavor to do is really to stay very lean. There are three people in our group that do all of this work, Daniel Christensen, who's a senior planner, and myself, and we've just added my colleague who's right behind us, Denver Peterson, who's an expert in databases, so he's helping us manage through a lot of this. We partner for capacity. So we've partnered with other agencies, Dogami, OEM, DLCD, SHPO, OBDD, other agencies to gain capacity and using their expertise to build our own. We use pilots.
Please.
You trouble me a little bit when you say that because of the agencies that you just ticked off, all the acronym agencies. I was listening very thoughtfully, and a number of those agencies, in my experience, have some pretty profound built-in bias about a variety of things. Division of state lands, right-thinking people can disagree over what they have jurisdictional authority over. Dogami, that has been trying to, Department of Mineral and I wasn't going to use acronyms, but I've used that one for so long I can't remember its real name.
Geology and Mineral Industries.
Geology and Mineral Resources.
Right.
They have spent so much time in of late building their power base that they were trying to insinuate themselves into go, no-go decisions in land use along the coast. And so when you say that you are partnering for capacity, it troubles me that some of that policy bias might slip into what ought to be a completely objective database.
I think so. Senator Johnson, Chair, thank you.
It's okay. We've got a lot to talk about. I'm cool if you just want to keep going.
Thank you. What we are using is information from those agencies and in order to inform our understanding of our land assets and our facility assets. So to the agency that you referred, we are partnering with them to do risk assessments of the seismic, tsunami, and flood risks and geologic risks of state assets.
One more thing. I just haven't quite beaten this to death.
Sure.
I am told that the Department of Aggregate and Mineral Resources, heretofore referred to as DOGAMI, had done a great deal of very expensive research to do inventories of mineral assets, and that those reside in a box somewhere that have now gone missing. And so here's data that was paid for by the taxpayers that they've lost control over. How is your data being retained, and how is it secure?
Senator, I very much appreciate that question, because it is being retained in a database. And it's a database that and a data system that is easily accessible. And it's cloud-based. We're working on developing a data mart. So I think it's quite transparent. We're using the data that they have. We're also GIS enabling the data so that people can look at maps and actually visualize it and see it. So I think we're using it in as many platforms to make it as usable and as accessible as possible.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, so there are three initiatives that we're working on. The facilities assessment that George mentioned, at this point we've done about 20% of our portfolio, and we're doing another 1.2 million square foot of assessments for the Department of Corrections by the end of this biennium. So we'll be close to 25% of our portfolio. We're doing the data integration and visualization, which we'll take a look at a little bit later. And part of our assessment is looking at our natural hazard risks so that we understand how we're investing, and that will also help guide our decisions.
How many folks are doing this review of natural hazard risks? Again, in DOGAMI's breathtaking overreach of their responsibilities, in my opinion, they were assaying for seismic durability. How many times do we have to look at this stuff? Do you have any confidence that there isn't gross redundancy?
So on that matter, we are partnering. We're doing a pilot of evaluating 61 of the buildings of DAS, OIA, and OLCC. We are working with PSU and DOGAMI. And DOGAMI, in this case, Yume Wong, is on rotation to our office to actually develop this pilot with us. And we're really advancing work that's already been done for the Oregon University system and for OBDD on their benefit cost analysis tool. So we're basically advancing work that's already been done to have best practice.
I'm glad that you have a person working with you of Yume Wong's caliber. I think she is an outstanding scientist and a state employee. So
we agree. So the road to the 10-year plan, I'm going to go through this quickly. I think the point of this is to say we're not doing a master plan. We're really doing a strategic facility plan. And the difference is that a strategic facility plan is a shorter-term plan based on the business objectives, the strategic business objectives of the agency. Master plans are things that you do a bit later when you actually, and they're place-based. I think where we are now for most agencies is really looking at it from a strategic and business process as opposed to deciding exactly where an individual building might go. So this is a snapshot of what our facilities portfolio looks like. We've got 54 million square feet. 28 million of that is really the university system, or the seven universities, rather. And we have 21 million square feet and 21 and a half that is owned by the 17 state agencies. Let's see, leased facilities are about 4.5. So looking at what the portfolio is that we're actually focused on, it is what the numbers that you see on the right, 21.5 million square feet of owned facilities, $5 billion in value, over 5,000 facilities for 40,000 employees. So looking at who actually owns these facilities, these are the 17 agencies that own facilities. And you can see the count of facilities and the gross square feet. The top four numbers there, corrections, DAS, transportation, and the military, own 3/4 of the portfolio. So everybody else is really quite a bit smaller.
Mr. Chair, I also point out that we talked a little bit earlier about Department of Transportation. Number three on that list, notice that they have 3.1 million square feet, but over 1,200 facilities. So that's counting all those small ones all over the roadside.
Right. So where are our top locations by number? By gross square foot, you can see, you know, Salem is the largest by a long margin. And if you look at it by the location, Salem, again, is the largest. But the other locations are different, as you can see.
So you have a question, Senator?
Yeah, I do.
Senator.
If you go back one slide.
Sure.
So how many, you have a gross about 4.3, 4.2 million square feet that you manage, own or manage?
Perfect.
That's correct.
And you had a 900,000 square foot error on one building?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Witsit, no, this is the data after we got it collected and kind of cleaned up a little bit. When we did one of the original databases, we found that there was one that was grossly, in the original data set, was incorrect.
Don't you manage your properties by the square foot?
No, actually, we manage it by the building and by the location, so by each entity.
If an agency wants to lease a space in a building, you don't have to go by square foot?
Well, we do that, too. I mean, there's many metrics along which we manage it, but how do we track it? Is that
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit, we were not charging an agency for 1 million square feet, if that's where you're headed for. We do charge for uniform rent based on square footage, but that was not the database I was talking about. It was,
no.
Yeah. Well, I'm confident that you weren't, but it seems, and again, I'm not blaming you, but it seems odd that you could have missed, or somebody could have missed 20% of the charges of the entire square footage.
Madam Chair, Senator Witsit, that's when we saw the data pop up. It made our eyes immediately pop. I think no one was just looking at the data in that database. And that's the only point I was making, is no one was looking at the data until we started digging into it.
Senator Johnson, I'm sorry.
Yes,
sir. Mr. Coacher. No, it's fine. I don't care. But go ask away.
A quick question for you. Yeah. You folks have a policy option package in for $2 million to do some additional assessment. Share with us, one, what's going to be in the assessment, and then two, which of these agencies are going to be part of that $2 million
Happy to do it. I'm going to move forward to that section then. Can I do that?
So just highlight, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. The $2 million package, you can talk about what's in the assessment, but the next ones in the chute would be corrections, and which is number one on this list, and forestry, which is number seven.
So that would be the next one. So for the policy option package, those are the two that we're going to be looking at?
Actually, and I think we will be able to do a bit more.
Okay. And when you we're talking all of the facilities within DOC?
Correct.
Okay. Can you share with me what will be contained within those assessments?
So what those assessments are is that there are teams of architects and engineers and professional facility assessors that go through and do a inventory and an assessment of the condition of an entire building from the roof and the envelope to the individual water heater. So they will barcode pieces of equipment, and all of this from the, you know, individual asset to kind of the global building and agency level, all of that is submitted and prepared and put into a database that is a software system that allows us to use it going forward for planning on an ongoing basis.
Okay, so really quick follow-up. So, sure. And this is no commentary on you folks, okay? Please don't take it. Any reason why we haven't been doing this in the past?
I wasn't here.
We're glad you're here.
Okay, before we go off the slide, Senator Johnson has a quick question.
Are you ground? Yeah, I do. Are you? I'm looking at number 15, aviation. Are you ground truthing this with the department? I know that department pretty well, and I'm trying to figure out where they got 24 buildings, unless you're counting airports, and then they got 28 of them. I don't know where that 24 number came from. I know at Pacific City they've got a little hutch that looks like a roadside shrine that you can sign the guest book. But there's no building there. I'm just trying to figure out, are you double-checking this with the agencies?
We have double-checked with the agencies, most of the larger agencies. The smaller ones, we've been operating out of the database that we have right now. So that is part of our overall process, that we'll be going back to every agency and doing exactly that, the ground truthing. But another big piece of it is that, especially for the larger agencies, having someone out there in the field to actually verify what they have and correct the data is a really valuable thing.
Why would you guys do that when you can call up Mitch Schwecker at Aviation, who does have people in the field? And I'm thinking about the state's aviation assets are scattered literally from the Nevada border all over the state.
Right.
And maybe that's a bad example because you guys might not waste time on a little agency that's that small, but I'm just trying to figure out, he does have people. Why wouldn't you just send him an email and say, hey, Mitch, this look right to you? And he's going to shoot you back an email that says, I think that's wrong.
Yeah, but your point is a good one, and we will do that too. And we haven't done it with every agency. This is true, Senator. But we will.
Okay, so I'm going to follow up.
We have actually been concentrating on the largest agencies and moving through in that manner.
I would remind the committee, and then Mr. Coach, I'll get to you. I would remind the committee that we just approved this position that, remind me how to pronounce your last name, my apologies.
Vivel.
Ms. Vivel assumed in the last budget cycle, in the budget for the 13-15 biennium, and I don't know how fast you managed to come over. They managed to steal you from OUS. And bring you over, but
no.
It sounds like you're hearing us loud and clear, and you agree that there are. I mean, I think I'm actually hearing two separate things. That you need to get information from the people on the ground, whether even your count is correct, but that there are things that trained people can assess in terms of square footage and what really counts as a building and what doesn't count as a building. That employees of the agency might not necessarily be best equipped to assess. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's correct, Madam Chair. I think the value in getting a professional assessment, a third-party assessment, is that it's exactly that, a third-party professional assessment, so that the data we have is apples for apples, and that we make sure that all of the management is not just at the building level, but down to the asset level, and so that we can plan and prioritize not just within each agency, but across the enterprise, because not all agencies have facilities that are in the same condition, that pose the same level of risk to the state. So it's that whole risk management piece of this work that needs to be done comprehensively.
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, thank you. Can you get for the committee a listing of what's going to be, and I don't want paragraphs, bullet points, of what's going to be included in those assessments? I'm starting to think of a policy option package of $2 million and looking at 336 facilities in the Department of Corrections. Other than a cursory view, I'd be curious as to what level of detail is going to be involved.
We'd be happy to do that and share examples of the work that's already been completed.
Yeah, that'd be great. I want to see the bullet points of here are the things we tick off. And in particular, I'd like to really know what's the useful life of these facilities.
That's exactly what is assessed as they go through, component by component. They look at when it came into use and what is the remaining useful life.
Let me ask one more question on that just really quick.
Sure.
Is there, and I know we're not doing appraisals on these, okay, so I get that, but is there any way to determine what their value is to the state of Oregon?
That is part of what is delivered.
Perfect. I'd love to see this.
Yes.
That way it'll probably stump most people.
Sure.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
So I'm going to go very quickly through. Actually, no. I'm going to really go quickly.
Well, just highlight what that one was, just so people can see it first.
Okay.
Because I want you to see, members of the committee, what this data set is that we're talking about, because we don't usually look at these things this way.
So this is the mean age of facilities in the state. 53 years, 1962. So that has obvious implications.
Okay, what's the 1860 building?
I don't know.
I know.
It's actually listed there.
Oh, there it is. I'm saying Thompson Mills State Heritage Site. So we have 4.6 million leased, and it's 20% of the portfolio. You know, human services is by far the largest lessor. In the next 3 years to 2017, we've got approximately 2.5 million square feet of leases that are coming due, that are open for renewal. So a big opportunity is for us to look at this and see where there are opportunities for consolidation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. Largest lessor in square footage or number of outpost facilities?
I think the answer is both.
Okay. And the second point I'd like to raise, in previous sessions, I've been very interested in encouraging, maybe even trying to push the state toward collaborating with local government. Mm-hmm. There are times when I think we assume we ought to do something because we're the big fish in the sea, but maybe there's a local community that has a building that they would like to upgrade or build or purchase, and we could be a tenant in it, but this collaboration might be what makes it economically feasible for them to move ahead with their local community needs. So I am going to be interested in hearing from you as you talk about leases coming up, how you are analyzing those opportunities to make sure that we're being as collaborative as possible with the idea of helping local communities as well as just looking for solving our own needs.
Thank you. Do you want to comment on that before you go on?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, what I would like to say on this one is, up until now, when Alice came on board, we weren't looking at it from this perspective. But we were looking at each individual lease when it would come up, and not thinking about 3 years down the road, we got another big one coming up in this geographic region. What can we do? Who can we partner with to get a much better deal? So this is the baseline data over the last year that Alice has been on board, where we're starting to ask different questions.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
I'm really glad that you have the staff in place and the agency policy direction in place. It is disappointing to hear that this has been raised by this subcommittee and probably others for a lot of years, and why it's not as if it would have just occurred to you. Perhaps it was a question of resources in your own department, but at least we're there now. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
I was just going to follow on to Representative Nathanson's comment that not only is there local government and state government opportunities for efficiencies, but also in many instances it may serve the client better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We are having just these discussions with the community of Brookings right now.
Great.
Did Brookings come to you, or did you seize an opportunity there?
Brookings came to us. But we already had a relationship with Brookings. So
That raises the larger question. In what venue is the welcome mat out for these kind of cooperations? Because I know that with ODOT, where ODOT was looking at shared facilities with county government, like a shared maintenance shed or facility, they went to quite an effort for outreach. And I don't know if you're prepared to put out the welcome mat to say to communities, come on down, let's see if there's a collaborative opportunity here.
We would love that. But again, we're just building capacity right now. But I think that is our gold standard. That's what we would love to do. And I think that that's really the essential function of state. For the state, we can do things that nobody else can do.
And Ms. Vivell and Mr. Naughton, we are getting crunched for time.
Okay.
But what I was going to say is this. You might want to think about which slides you have left you can do in the next 5 minutes and are useful to you. What I'm going to ask committee members to do is to take responsibility based on the conversations that we've had to look through the remaining slides that we don't get to, get back to Mr. Siebert, Co-Chair Smith, and me with any specific questions. If it turns out we have a lot more questions, we may ask you to come back when DAS comes back with other stuff. And if not, then, Representative Smith,
all right, so we've got about 3.5 minutes. Why don't you just give us a few final points here and we'll wrap it up.
Okay. Well, I think my big point would be that the most important thing that we could do is really the facility conditions assessment and putting that in the database. And that without that and having really apples to apples, there's no way to really understand what we're managing. I think that that's the most critical thing. So I would ask you to consider funding that policy option package. The other thing that we're doing is we're looking at new technologies, modern technologies, ones that actually we already have to visualize data and create opportunities to integrate data so that it's easy to use and transparent. We've developed an app that actually just won a special achievement in GIS award, this website that looks at having our KPIs or KPMs, you know, key performance measures for our buildings, and we piloted it for the mall and DAS's buildings so you could see it transparently, easily on a website.
So, let's click through a couple of these so that people can just see the
visualization. We're going to have to go real quick here.
Yeah, it's not going to take fast.
Okay, so that's the revenue building.
Got it.
And this is
density by floor.
By floor.
Okay, that's what the different colors are.
So this
is flood maps.
So here's the state lands building. Here's the Mill Creek. This is Normal. This is a 100-year FEMA flood plain. 500, everything is underwater, agriculture, veterans, state lands.
So skip to the next one.
And this is...
Is this energy usage?
No, this is, operating cost by square foot.
Wonderful.
So this looks at using a color ramp to define what's operating well and not so well. Oops. And this uses a bar chart kind of
same
symbology. It's the same information. But the value of using the 3D is you can see it in context. Mm-hmm. You can see the three-dimensional quality of the buildings and kind of surmise how that has an impact on what it is that you're looking at.
So, Madam Chair, if I can just kind of wrap this up, all we want to do is give you some teasers. This is not just about assessing the
building itself. Mm-hmm. It's then trying to merge other data systems together about how dense is the floor, how much more people could we potentially put in there, what's the usage of energy inside the building. There's a lot of things that once you get the baseline data, you can cross-tab with other data sets we already have to then get this more robust picture of the buildings overall, because we're not, it's not just managing the asset, it's managing the business that we're trying to get our arms wrapped around.
And I think from a community perspective, ultimately what we want to do is be the aggregators for things like demographic information to visualize that, transportation systems, all kinds of things that affect a community. So where we make investments, that it's not just a defensible investment, it's the best investment. So that's our aspiration.
All right.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, yep. I would just say I really appreciate your coming in with this kind of detailed information. We're not where we want to be, but we're getting there. And I think there was some uncertainty 2 years ago when we were considering this position about what we would get for our money. It's pretty clear it was the right decision. And so, at least from my perspective, in terms of really understanding what we're getting and understanding whether we're using our physical assets to the best possible advantage. So I appreciate your coming in with this level of detail and reassuring us that we made the right choice. Thank you.
All right. Colleagues, any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. We apologize for the musical gavel here the last little bit of time, but it worked. Paul, is there anything we need to think about?
It's Georgia.
All right. Julie, we good? All right. We are going to adjourn.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We are going to adjourn.
Thank you.
Yeah.